problem with the state working with claimants to ensure that there is a proper process to think through what needs to be done and that whatever is needed to be done actually succeeds. The last question on tax. One of the bodies that account to Parliament, and that opposition parties should perhaps monitor very closely, is the South African Statistics South Africa, which and also figures on the Reserve Bank. Those two bodies are important for Parliament and opposition parties to monitor very closely. They show, for example, that in 1999 and 2010, we saw a situation where non-financial firms had in reserves some 535 billion rands, money that they could not invest in production or in anything. I'm building a story here. Also, this same bodies show that our gross domestic product for 2012 is $384 billion. Our gross national product for the same year, $572.6 billion. Financial firms alone have 3 trillion rands in assets. This basically makes a point that our country has the resources to afford land restitution. As Professor Hall has said, where money is gotten from depends on the political will, and that's what we're calling on Parliament to do. The Parliament, this committee, must argue very strongly for an adequate budget for land reform, land restitution as a whole. The country has the resources. We saw, instead of taking these resources for this purpose, we saw Minister Manuel, when during this period, reducing company tax rates for a successful period of some 9 years, which basically deprived land restitution and other crucial services and constitutional goals of the resources they needed. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Professor Walker is not here. You're here? Okay.
You're here. I'm briefly. Thank you. I was asked a quite challenging question, I think, which also linked up with some of the other comments that were being made that were not directed to me directly. And that was about the cry of the dispossessed for land and the importance of taking that seriously and the responsibility of Parliament to respond to that and to act, and that's what the decision has been made. I think my comments were attempting to acknowledge that, but I was also trying to raise some critical questions that I think it's incumbent on government to weigh up. They have to take in all these a whole range of considerations and really reflect on them and often make difficult decisions in terms of priorities, etc. So it seems to me that it's critical that this committee engage critically with all the inputs that are being received, as I'm sure is the intention. I think the point that I was making was not that land, that there is not a cry for land, and that land should not be part of the package of redress options that I was suggesting. What I was saying, one of the major categories of claims, as we know, and that has been highlighted, is that of betterment. And the point that I was making was precisely that there are other ways of addressing the very real land issues and needs in the case of betterment, and that restitution, and the Act, is a poor vehicle for actually dealing with the land issues that arise in relation to betterment. The other point that I think is quite important to make is that around redress and the way in which questions are asked and answers are framed, is that not all claimants, in my experience, and as I think some of the research has shown, necessarily do want land. And very often it's also a matter of how it's posed, and if the choice is between ancestral land or a house in town or however it might be, or where they are currently living, or investment in education or health services in the place to which they were moved 40, 50 years ago, the answers might be quite different. So it was trying to think about and challenge us and also to challenge claimants to think about alternative forms of redress, but that not to rule out land in all cases at all. But to call on, I think we have a responsibility to engage very critically with the whole spectrum of issues in making these decisions, and that my comments were attempting to show the limitations of the Restitution Act to address the kinds of heartfelt claims and needs that were being articulated. Thank you.
Thank you. As they say,
We hear about people crying for the restoration of their land, but they feel they've been left behind in 98, and that there's this notion of giving people land, also give them power, taking away the land render them powerless. But we have way too many examples where people got land without any further empowerment, and then stripped those farms, and eventually, when there was nothing left on the farms, they left too. It's nobody's interest. You cannot eat land. It's not about that piece of land. A farm is much more than just a piece of land. A farm is a business. It's a business plan. It's a lot of investment. It's a whole system which you put on the land, and very often, it is more valuable, actually, than the land. We are running a real risk if we do not match up agricultural development with the transfer of land, that we will reduce farms to just land again. It takes more time, but it really needs to be done. It will be detrimental to food security if we do not do it that way. Things have changed a lot in 100 years. The world has become very small. We are in constant competition with the best farmers in the world all the time. And I welcome the explicit notion here from members of the ruling party to say how important food security is. We really appreciate, for example, what was done in Parliament over the last few months in the chicken industry to protect our own farmers. Because the fact is that it is probably the most transformed sector in agriculture is the chicken industry. It's much quicker and easier to make to turn money in the chicken industry than, for example, in the forestry industry. But no one could make a living because we could not compete with people from Latin America on chicken production. And eventually, it is in this house that you have to weigh the options. Should we allow cheaper access to food on the shelves by importing cheap chicken, or should we protect our own industry? The choice was that we will protect our own industry, but just about every industry is at this stage under pressure because we cannot compete with the rest of the world. And just like you cannot make water run upstream, you cannot let food and fiber flow from less competitive areas to more competitive areas. We must maintain our competitiveness. Will we remain a partner of government? Should there be reopening? Of course we will. Even if government decides to burn the country down, we will still be here. We will always engage constructively. There is no option than to do that. And remember, we have also gained in organized agriculture from land reform in terms of membership. Many beneficiaries of land reform are members of our affiliations. Many of them have actually built out the membership basis of our commodity organizations dramatically over the last few years. So when we speak about land reform, we do not only speak of people who owned land for generations on commercial farms. There are actually today more people engaged in commodity organizations who have entered the sector over the last 5-6 years than there are well-established farmers in those structures. But then it's important for us that they are farmers and not just landowners. That's the important part. What do we bring on board? What can we contribute? Well, I firstly want to state it very categorically that the commercial farmers of South Africa are not the biggest landowners. Yes, we all own a form, some two or three, four forms. But the bank, the banks and the agricultural cooperatives, they own all our farms. I know very few farmers who are actually farming on a cash basis. We put our land up as collateral and we borrow money from the banks. And if we cannot repay, they will dispossess us. They will put it up on auction. And you live with that risk all the time. There's no motivator on a farm as effective as a bank manager on your neck. But that risk is not prevalent in land reform. Land reform beneficiary is not from the risk of losing his land. On the positive side, on the negative side, they do not have access to finance. Government has positioned itself as the primary financier of agricultural development. And until there is proper ownership and an open market on land, we will not unfreeze the capital which we need to really remain our competitiveness in a super technological era. We firmly believe that with reopening, we are going to lose a few more farmers. They will go bankrupt because they do not develop further. And it's not something which is unique to South Africa. All over the world, you have this phenomenon that large farmers are growing bigger all the time and smaller farmers are dropping out of the industry because our profitability is so closely linked to the economy of scale. There is one way to maintain the family farm and the smaller enterprise like they are doing in Europe, and that's through heavy subsidies. And of course we would love that, but we are not putting our hearts on.
Thank you very much. There were comments made about the Kripas. Are you fine with that? Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Although, and with all respect, that members of the committee urge us to be relaxed, we must stay here today that we cannot be relaxed because we have been fighting really for many, many years and even decades and even centuries to get back our land that was dispossessed. If you know the history of South Africa, you will know what I mean. And then I also want to say that it was mentioned that certain people did not even know that we already engaged about this issue with the negotiators in the CODESA rooms. We did. We made a presentation. But we went further than that. And we went to the United Nations. And we made presentations in front of the United Nations Working Group on Indigenous Populations. And that was in 1997, 1998. And we asked them to persuade the South African government to allow the Khoi San people to claim land prior to 1930. In 2005, the Special Rapporteur of the United Nations came to South Africa, the Special Rapporteur on Indigenous Issues. And in his report you can read how he also addressed the issue of the 1913 cut-off date and how he asked the South African government please to allow Christian people to claim land prior to 1930. Up till now, nothing has been done in that regard. Only to hear that, that even in this new amendment bill that we will not be recognized once again. So we cannot be relaxed with all due respect. We must really accelerate our efforts now. And we will do so in 2014 and put much more pressure on the government to and on the international community to help us to get our rightful place in terms of not only land but other issues in South Africa. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Let's proceed and take three last presenters. Mr. Parks from COSATU.
Thanks very much, Chairperson. I assume, Chair, that the committee members have received copies of our written submission, but I won't read it. I'll just do an oral summary very briefly. Let me also say, Chair, just best wishes for the new year for members, compliments for the season, and all protocol observed. I think, Chair, we would also wish to have a strong relationship with this committee as COSATU, as land reform is one of our key political objectives. And we're also glad, Chair, to see a former COSATU leader chairing this committee as well. So it gives us some comfort. Not to put you in a corner. Chair, this committee, or this bill rather, was a bit difficult for us. And I must say we had the benefit of participating in the NEDLAC tasking process around this bill last year. So most of our comments would be included in the NEDLAC reports. We have difficulties that politically we support the objective of giving people a second chance to make claims. We agree that not everybody is able to make claims for a variety of reasons by the original cut-off date of 1998, so we will support the chance to give poor, dispossessed persons a second chance. I think we will also support the objective of giving victims of betterment schemes, rather, a chance as well to make claims. And for us, those are very important political objectives. I think, Chair, our concerns more around what is not said in the bill and around contextual issues. I think, Chair, we were first concerned that we felt that the bills rushed very fast by the department. And I think because things are rushed, because elections are approaching, government civil officers coming to an end and they want to conclude certain issues, we felt that rushness unnecessarily creates concerns or question marks among civil society, among the public, and so on. If one had dealt with this bill maybe a year earlier, many of those issues would have been avoided. I think, Chair, one of our major concerns is the impact upon existing claimants. According to the department, there's about 2,700 claims out of the original 71,000 which are yet to be concluded. And they also said to us that there's an additional 5,000 claims, roughly, of which they don't have a record, but the claimants have proof that they have submitted these claims. So about 7,500 claims which must still be processed. And that's over a period since 1998, so 16 years almost. And they're yet to be settled. And I think many people have also mentioned that there are existing claims where court orders were issued in favor of the claimants, and yet they couldn't be settled. I think that Dr. Ruth Hall mentioned one in the Northern Cape. We also understand there's others in the Eastern Cape. And our concern there, Chair, is that if for the past 15, 16 years those couldn't be settled, and we are reopening the window again, what happens to them now? Will there not be an additional 5-year delay plus? What happens to a claim which was made, and now there's a new claim for the very same area of land? And we had a sense from the department that, well, it was processed both simultaneously and it would improve the capacity and so on. But I think, Chair, that's for us is a fundamental concern. We wouldn't want to see people who have waited 15 years already wait more years. Chair, around the issue of the 1913 cut-off date, so we know that it was not in the bill, but we mentioned it because politically it was mentioned in public that this would deal with the 1913 issue. We understand from the department that will come in a further bill down the road. So we won't go into too much detail, but just said we were concerned about the practical implications of how would you deal with claims before 1913. Yes, politically you would want to give a chance to someone who lost his land to Jan van Riebeeck in the 1600s, but practically, given the nature of oral history, documentary history, given the nature of human migration, how would one deal with claims in KZN? Would people from Zimbabwe come and claim back land in KZN? Those kind of practical issues. I think, Chair, another one of our major concerns was the issue of the role of traditional leaders. And we recognize that traditional leaders are a constitutionally recognized institution in the country. But yet, as many court cases have shown, they are conflicts in rural areas. And we're very concerned about that. One of our concerns is that the reopening will also benefit traditional leaders at the expense of ordinary rural residents. And I fear that with the court orders being issued, for example, that they're now being delayed because traditional leaders have lost objections. We know that other bills here dealing with the role of traditional leaders, which are also kind of being delayed or stuck for a variety of reasons. But that politically, Chair, for us is an important concern. I think, Chair, the issue of the coin is one, politically one sympathizes, but the practical concern is how would one engage in the process of giving land to descendants of the coin is one. We know it's a very difficult thing, there are no easy answers or shortcuts. Chair, I think one thing we are happy with is that the productivity claim or requirements for claimants has been removed from the bill. We were strongly opposed to placing victims of land theft, the burden of having to prove productivity. For business is about a land restitution, it's not a productivity issue. Chair, in terms of the judiciary, we remain concerned for two issues. One is that we feel the judges are not experts in land valuation, and to place upon them the powers to determine the values, we feel it's a bit difficult or not desirable. We also concerned, Chair, that the Land Claims Court is a part-time court, and this is another delay in the process. So we also hope, Chair, that this will be dealt with in a holistic, comprehensive review of all the department's policies. We had hoped that the Green Paper Land Reform would become a white paper, and that all the different policies would be dealt with one time properly, because they're all really interlinked. It's difficult to divorce them. But we understand from the Minister that there won't be a white paper coming, and so we must just deal with what they've got on the table as it comes. I think lastly, Chair, we share the concerns around the issue of costing. We know it's difficult to come with an exact figure for what the future might bring, but we do feel it's worrying that if you have a potential of 2.5 million measurement claimants, or even up to 7.5 million if you include the descendants, and no money has been allocated, and the department doesn't have infinite resources, it's worrying. I think, Chair, just to give it a top-up example, we're worried about the mala-mala compensation. We thought that was excessive. We support you getting over the land, but a billion rands, we have two of those cases will bankrupt the department, there'll be nothing left. I think Kosata's position on compensation says that we don't believe in compensation if the land is taken illegally in the first place. So in terms of the NEDLAC process, we had engaged with it at NEDLAC, but we were concerned that the NEDLAC process hadn't been concluded.
So why did you say your position is on compensation, Mr.
Van? So we don't support compensation for land theft. If someone's land is taken illegally during apartheid, we don't believe that person should be compensated. We understand government's constraints, but that's our political position. Chair, our concern around the NEDLAC process, that whilst we had a good engagement around in the tasking level, but the department took the bill to cabinet whilst the NEDLAC process was still ongoing. And I assume that's why in the bill submitted to the committee, the NEDLAC process isn't mentioned, and the NEDLAC report, I assume, is not tabled. For us, Chair, that wasn't a good precedent. The Time Center and NEDLAC were agreed at the department, and we thought the government should honour that commitment. Conclusion, Chair, to summarise, we support the objectives of reopening. We support giving betterment victims a chance to make claims. We're happy that productivity requirement has been removed, but our concerns remain, especially around delays for existing claimants, the unsaid role of traditional leaders, and of course, Chair, I guess at a later stage, the issue of the 1913 issues. I think, Chair, let me stop there, and thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I will now invite Dr. Klassen, Center for Law and Society.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you for being afforded this opportunity to make a submission, an oral submission about the bill. Let me just start by saying that these issues of landlessness and the legacy of conquest and of the Land Act are very serious and painful, and that it must have been, you know, a very devastating experience for the members of this committee to go to all the different rural areas and hear people's stories about how desperately they need land and how long they've waited and their frustration about the slow pace of land reform. So it's in that context really that our submission, which we've submitted a long document, raises the question about whether this bill is the right way to deal with that pent-up frustration and anger. And more than that, whether this bill will end up doing more harm than good, in that it will raise hopes that cannot be met, and it will actually obstruct the resolution of outstanding claims. And really, you know, the fundamental issue seems to be to do with the complaints that people brought. People came and said, you know, people are saying, yes, many of us missed the boat, but others are saying, we've made these claims, we've waited 15 years, some of them have got court orders, some of them have got approved settlements, and the land is still not being transferred to us. And people have given a whole range of reasons to do with their claims being lost, the way they've been treated by officials, accusations of corruption, and it seems to me that there are real questions about how the bill would address those really serious, intractable problems facing the restitution program. That, you know, the Program for Land and Agrarian Studies has told us that of the 80,000 claims lodged, 30,000 haven't been settled, and those are mostly rural claims. So in 15 years, most of the rural claims have not been finalized. People are still waiting. People are desperate. And the solution is then to open the process up to further claims, rather than to look at what has held up the claims that people have already lodged. And in a sense, you know, the issue comes back firmly to this question about political will, the broader context of land reform in general, and the budgetary allocation for land reform. And the department itself has estimated that it will cost up to $179 billion to fund the proposed reopening. And yet, in the 15 years so far, it has spent a total of $22.5 billion. So to say that this is what it's going to take, and to reopen claims on that basis, and to raise hopes on that basis, and to create rights in law without the capacity to actually implement the law, without a massive reallocation of the fiscus to back up that promise, seems to us to be a kind of shock that is being proffered in this pre-election period. And I really think that one's got to take seriously these questions about the timing of the bill and some of the underlying problems that it seeks to hide and seeks to resolve. And for that, we need to look a bit more broadly at some of the issues that have been raised in many of these submissions, particularly the department's failure to transfer land to CPAs. We thought it was just in the Eastern Cape, then we thought, no, it's also in Northwest, then we discovered it's in Mpumalanga, then we see it's in Limpopo, we see people, group after group, saying our claim was finalized, the minister signed off, title hasn't been transferred. And when we've spoken to people in the department, they said, well, you know, that's just coincidence. But it's not coincidence. In the litigation to do with the Tata restitution claim in the Eastern Cape, a senior official of the department made an affidavit in which she said that the reason that the title has not been transferred to the community is because of opposition by traditional leaders. She further stated in a sworn affidavit that the minister is trying to implement the Communal Land Rights Act, still trying to implement the Communal Land Rights Act that was struck down by the Constitutional Court and has imposed a moratorium on the transfer of land to communal property associations. Last year, the department announced a whole slew of new policies, one of which was basically to do with communal land, and in that policy document the department said that they're looking at no more communal property associations, those are elected structures owning land within the form of Vantage. Instead, they're looking at transferring the title of the outer boundaries of communal land to traditional leaders, and people would have use rights in those areas. That was actually at the heart of the multi-year litigation against the Communal Land Rights Act, because Section 25 creates property rights, creates a right to restitution, and what was actually at issue is that by giving rights, giving ownership of land that people have a restitution right to, or a tenure right to, or ownership to, giving that to traditional leaders who will completely outnumber them, would undermine their legal rights. And that's really something which the department can't get away from, that if you take tribal, if you trump the boundaries of land from which people were removed, and to which people have rights on the basis that they were removed from those specific boundaries, and you trump those boundaries by the bigger tribal boundaries created by the 1951 Act, you undermine the legal constitutional rights of people on that land. So the department must know that it can't get away with that, because court papers have been drawn up, they're all, the case is ready to roll, and the same arguments would apply again. So it's our concern, and I hope I'm wrong in this, it's our concern that to get around that problem, the department has come up with a proposal that it will reopen the restitution process and thereby enable traditional leaders to make counterclaims, which will then be used against the claims of the CPAs whom they refused to transfer land to for over 10 years, and it will be much more difficult to prove that that is an undermining of property rights in this context than it would have been if they had actually enacted a law pursuant to that communal land tenure policy. I'm afraid that more and more of these cases have come to light, and there seems to be no doubt that this is a dynamic in the process. Now, if it isn't a dynamic in the process, all that needs to be done is for this bill to be amended to state clearly that the processing of existing claims will not be held back by the lodgement of counterclaims. And if the department or the parliament doesn't add that proviso to the bill, then I'm afraid it confirms absolutely what the hidden motivation in this legislation is. And I must also say that the fear that this bill is really about political grandstanding prior to the elections is also illustrated by how the Khoisan have been treated. That when the President announced this legislation, he gave the impression that the Khoisan, that this legislation would address the problems of the Khoisan. And we know that in certain of the hearings, the chairperson of this committee has also assured Khoisan people that this bill will help them. Well, obviously it won't help them because of the 1913 cut-off date. And we're told that that cannot be adjusted because it's in the Constitution. Now, the Constitution creates a floor of rights. And the Constitution specifically provides for a law to create rights to restitution. It is completely within the competence of this Parliament, in this law, to give something more than the minimum that the Constitution provides. So if Parliament wanted to, in this law, go further back than the 1913 date, there's nothing in the Constitution that stops it from doing that. There's nothing in the Constitution that stops it from recognizing these kinds of claims. So what I'm really saying is this land reform is really, really difficult, and it's crucially important, and people are desperately needing to get land reform in one or other guise. And it's partly because of the failure of tenure reform and redistribution that people have put all their hope in restitution. Because at least restitution gives you something concrete, gives you a piece of land or it gives you compensation. It's not nebulous. It can't be trumped by Mr. Diakha's productivity requirements. So what I'm saying is, why the hurry? If this bill was to address the Khoisan problem, it could do so. If this bill was to address the problems that people are facing, the existing problems, it would need to investigate what those are and how those would be jeopardized by reopening the process. So I'm saying, really, why is it being rushed to you now, just before the elections? We've heard that it's a Section 75 bill, which means that for it to get through, it would have to be rushed through the National Council of Provinces without any time to really look at these questions of the possibility that this bill could backfire and that the intention of this committee, which is clearly to help all those desperate people, would end up raising false hope and backfiring on those who are already stuck in the queue.
Thank you. Let's now hear the Legal Resource Center. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Smith. I'm a human resource center, and I'm standing for...
I told me that addressed you last year at the ad hoc committee. He can't hear, unfortunately. He couldn't change his commitments. Chair, this... the Legal Resources Center is a public interest law firm. We represent claimant communities, amongst other communities, a number of whom are amongst the 20,000 unfinalized claims, not finalized claims. We do not get money from government. We like working with government, and we've been doing so for a while, except for the silicosis case and the Marikana Commission. Chair, with me is Gomin Wickham. She's going to present on two points. And Mr. Steve Karnovich, who's a former acting Land Claims Court judge, also contributed to the paper that is included in your bundle, honorable members, at number 14. We also have a PowerPoint presentation, and we have handouts that we'd like to give to you. But I am going to refer to our written submission and the page numbers of our written submission, which is number 14 among four bundles. Have you got one, Chair? Chair, the LRC supports improvement of the law, and we support this debate. And this debate has become very rich in the light of your experiences and your hearings that you've held all over the country. We welcome the deletion of Clause 9 because of the draft bill, because it was not in conformance with the Constitution. But we are concerned that the Clause 9 type conditionalities can creep in through the back door of administrative practice under the recap policy and under the settlement agreement in a case such as Papari that elevated feasibility, affordability and productivity are brought in as prerequisites for restitution. But Chair, on our contents page, our introduction is very well written. Yesterday in Gubuleti you gave an excellent introduction to this bill and policy. I wish I copied it out. But we'd like to say that our introduction is helpful in at the very least reading it. We're going to deal with each of the points raised in our contents page, but I want to say that three important things have happened since we've written this and since this bill was published in September. And they are crucial. The first one is your ad hoc committee report, in which your committee participated, of 15 October. And a very important first recommendation made in the ad hoc committee report, saying that
there must be a high-level vision and a white paper against which this template can be measured, the performance of policy and new legislation. Lacking that puts us in a difficult position. And you cannot measure this goal against a high-level policy where redistribution, tenure reform, and development support also has its equal place in the program. Number two, in December this year, this bill was tagged 76. We cannot have a six-week turnaround time before the elections. Why rush the bill now? A third very important development since the publication of this is the impact assessment. The regulatory impact assessment that's now a requirement for legislation to be brought to Parliament. So the regulatory impact assessment is dated 6th of August. Later that month is the redraft of the policy, and this bill is published in September. But the regulatory impact assessment and its proposals are not taken into account, are not carried in this bill, nor in the policy statement. What does the regulatory impact assessment of 160 pages say? You referred to it this morning. But we'd like to say that this 160-page document that evaluates the restitution program to date and makes proposals on the bill says, for our purposes, three things. It says what reopening means, 400,000 claims, 180 billion over 15 years. B, it says a phasing of the process and stage one will prioritize prior claims. Is this reflected in the bill? C, it says that pre-1913 dispossessions and claims for heritage sites and symbolic restoration and historical landmarks should be dealt with under the National Heritage Resources Act and the Redistribution Act, Act 126. And that there should be a stakeholder in Daba. This is on page 88 of the impact assessment, the regulatory impact assessment. It also proposes this. There should be amendments to this bill. It lists 15 amendments on page 121 and 14 on page 30 before enactment. Quote, this legal assessment has identified a number of key legislative and administrative issues that need to be considered in determining the final wording of the 2013 Restitution of Land Rights Amendment Bill prior to its enactment. Page 30 of the RIA. When is this going to happen? We need to do it. Some of those we don't agree with, but some of them are important. It includes, according to the RIA, the prioritization of the existing claims, of the prior claims. Significantly, the RIA also acknowledges current redistribution and policy and program does not benefit poor citizens. There's an overemphasis on restitution to carry the burden of that should be carried by redistribution. Current redistribution program envisioned beneficiaries as developing into commercial farmers. Chair, the slide that we've got here you're familiar with because it was in your ad hoc committee report and it comes from the department's presentation to you on the 19th of August last year. It says 20,000 claims not finalized after 20 years. 25% deficit after 20 years. 12,000 of them already settled on paper. Now if we add the RIA, we see there are 400,000 claims to be dealt with over 15 years. 60,000 claims had been dealt with 23 billion. 400,000 claims are going to be dealt with 180 billion rand. The budget challenge is the rest, is the next slide. Just briefly, on 31 October 2013, the department reported to you, so this slide comes from that presentation to you, Chair. Over the past 5 years, restitution made up 15 billion, of a $50 billion allocation to the department. Over the next 15 years, restitution will require $180 billion. In other words, an increase from $3 billion per year average over the past 5 years to $12 billion per year average. The backlog is on the next page. And I'm quoting from, in the first bullet, the quote is from the report of the department to you on the 31st of October last year. Currently there are total commitments, some of which are very old because they are untraceable claimants, changes in settlement options, unimplementable Section 42Ds. The second quote comes from your ad hoc committee report. The committee expressed concerns because 50% of the total land awarded, 1.5 million hectares, has not been dealt with. How do we deal with a backlog? If we know how to deal with a backlog, we'll understand how to pursue the challenge of reopening. We have four proposals in this regard. A strong independent commission, ring fence, insulate prior claims, the existing claims. Three, transfer of land must happen within 12 months unless the court directs another arrangement. Finally, real redistribution. Aggressive redistribution, tenure development, and development support programs for pro-poor and small-scale farming is necessary so that restitution does not carry an unfair burden. Chair, we say on page 5 of our submission and on slide number 7, which is on the screen there, we make the first two bullets are quotes from your ad hoc committee report, commenting on restitution, caring for the poor. Redistribution, your conclusion was, large sums of money are increasingly benefiting the few. The burden of addressing the unequal distribution of land pre-1994 is increasingly falling on the restitution program. If this trend continues, it will lead to an oversubscription of land claims that goes beyond the capacity of the restitution program. Restitution cannot be responsible for the NDP targets for rural development and land reform. Redistribution and development support must do its bit. Don't rush restitution into something that cannot fulfill the expectations of the NDP. On slide number 8, we make proposals for the independence of the commission and the strengthening of the commission, both at a policy level and not to be overwhelmed by Section 42Ds imposed by the department. We propose that all settlement agreements be considered by the court and made court orders to ensure certainty for all parties. Finally, the RIA is replete with references to the necessity to capacitate the commission. Those should be acted upon, and in fact the RIA says that there should be explicit legislative provision for the capacity of the commission. We make proposals about the appointment of independent regional commissioners, and on page 20 of our submission, in terms of section 62A, should be amended to say that the commission should report to both Parliament and the Land Claims Court on all settled claims, and not only, as it currently says, to itself. You strengthen the commission by making it accountable and to be accountable. On slide number 9, 12 months to transfer. It's in our submission on page 18. Write it into the law that if the claim is settled, there is 12 months to transfer it, unless you go back to court if you make another arrangement. Claims finalized before this bill becomes law should be required to be transferred within 12 months of its promulgation. Let's test ourselves and our resolve by dealing with the 20,000 claims now in the next 12 months. Because that's the target that we're setting for ourselves if we want to deal with 400,000 claims over the next 15 years. Share the most important substantive proposal that we have is prior claims must be insulated and ring-fenced. It's on paragraph 10. We've got specific wording in this regard, which we're proposing. It means an amendment of sections 1, 10, 11, 29 and 35. This will bring the security for the 20,000 outstanding claims and deal with the expectation, because we cannot wait for 5 years before we start addressing the backlog of 20,000 claims. It's not possible to do it under a policy guideline or an administrative provision. Insulation and ring fencing is required in terms of legislation. It does not mean that new claims, later claims, will be prejudiced, because we've written it in such a manner that it will comply with the rationality and justifiability requirements of the Constitution and the Equality Clause. Chair, I'm ending and I'm not going to explain my slide on betterment. Do we know enough about betterment? Do we need new law? Do we need tailor-made law? I've shown there Rustenburg has had 33. The Transvaal had 214 declarations. Rustenburg had 33 declarations. There were removals on top of one another. Bob mining law, Bob land law, and Bofutatwana mining law and land law, and pass laws were used to remove people and to reshape and reorder the spatial circumstances. The Restitution Act by itself is not appropriate to deal with that complexity. We need more than that. But do we know enough? Because the RIA only talks about Eastern Cape and mentions a report in KZN. Do we know enough on how to tackle the impact of betterment? Chair, my colleague is going to deal with Catherine Land Rights and a purposeful and purposive land claims court. But I want to say on the way forward, because it is the last slide, which you probably page to, yes, it is the time for implementation. It is implementation time for the 20,000 claims not yet finalized. And it is implementation time for land reform in our beautiful country, for our beautiful people, who have not as yet been touched by land reform in the past 20 years. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, I will be very brief. I just have two slides. I'm not going to be the first person to talk about Tashmi Kenya and its relationship to restitution today, and that's not an accident. It is because Tashmi Kenya remains the most neglected form of land rights in South Africa, for which there is no justification, because it affects millions of people. There is still today, despite the constitutional promise, there is still no statute that provides for security of tenure for people living on customary land. The Green Paper on Land Reform of 2010 also completely and explicitly excluded it from its ambit, and the most recent restitution policy that we received recently also does not mention it. And this is odd because the ad hoc committee of this committee and the regulatory impact assessment that you have and countless submissions that you heard across the country and here today tell you that there is a growing tension between restitution and the restitution program and traditional leadership in South Africa. And this tension cannot longer be ignored. We are here to tell you that it is a false tension, but if it is to be ignored, it will become fatal. And this is the cry of communities here. So what is the context? In 1994, when the Restitution Act was first promulgated, or 1998, when claims had to be done, and today, in 2013, the difference for the strength of customary Kenya is very little. What has changed is that in 2003, traditional leadership and their governance powers were entrenched in the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act. The mechanism, however, in that act that was supposed to ensure the democratization and accountability of these traditional leaders have all failed. And there's no denying that anymore. Your ad hoc committee itself refers to it. The problem with that is that traditional leaders have started to impose themselves and given them assumed positions of power way beyond the governance positions or government functions that may have been envisioned for them by the Constitutional Court in the certification judgment. And in this, the Restitution Act has for a long time been one mechanism for communities within the jurisdiction of traditional leaders to assert their rights against sometimes unaccountable leaders. We thus urge this committee to ensure that the Restitution Act, by recognizing communities and parts of communities, therefore communities within communities or sub-communities, that this remain the mechanism to be used for communities. We tell you that this tension that traditional leaders are creating by saying that they are indeed the owners of the land or custodians of the land, and to that extent that there cannot be any ownership of CBAs within their jurisdiction, that there is no legal basis for this assertion. And we have a full opinion on that, which we can distribute if you like. It was also contained in our first submission last year. In fact, we assert that this notion of sub-communities or community landholding within the jurisdiction of traditional leadership is absolutely in line with living customary law as is recognized by our constitution, and therefore it should be promoted rather than outlawed. We are in this regard very concerned about the mention on page 20 of the latest restitution policy of a rejection of the idea of communities within communities because it is bad for investment. It may be bad for investment, but it is absolutely good for communities who need to assert their rights to property, as Dr. Clarkson just also mentioned. We recommend to this committee that you ensure the protection and promotion of communal property associations within traditional council jurisdictions. There need not be a tension. Where appropriate, CBAs can be incorporated into traditional structures if appropriate. But this is part and can be an important mechanism of the democratization of traditional leadership structures and landholding in rural communities. And we therefore encourage this committee to not ignore this very crucial tension that is still arisen. Then finally, and very shortly, just a short point on the Purposeful Land Claims Court. And the challenge of the court, as we know, is the permanent lack of permanent employees to the Land Claims Court, which has caused incredible delays. Now, the solution proposed by the bill seems to be that the pool must be narrowed so that the JSC can only recommend candidates from the current pool of High Court judges. Now, experience shows, and common sense, I would suggest, shows that this solution will lead to even more delays, and severe delays is the biggest problem of the restitution process we know. So, our estimates have shown that if only 1% of the impact assessment's estimated valid claims are heard by the Land Claims Commission, and although each case only leaves evidence for 3 days, the court will face an additional 11,910 days of hearings, which is 6.5 years of hearings for 5 full-time judges if they never go on leave. We thus suggest that to limit the pool from which to extract Land Claims Court judges will be a serious mistake. And we rather recommend that the Land Claims Court follow the model of the Labour Court, which emphasizes knowledge of the relevant legal field, in this case land, rather than being a current High Court judge. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm informed that the commissioner want to respond to something.
Thank you very much, sir. I just wanted to just comment on the issue of whether we as commission transfer land into CBA. And just for the record, to say that the CBA Act that requires that we transfer land into the land into the hands of the claimant community who have received the land. We have internal problems where perhaps we are unable to transfer for one reason or the other, whether it's about vetting or because it's state land and so forth. But there is no policy that has been given to anybody to say that we cannot transfer land to CBAs. So I just want to place that on record, that there is no authority given to anybody.
I am responsible to sign off for those. There is no policy that is there that says that you cannot transfer land into space. Maybe perhaps the question that we should be asking ourselves is, how do we help each other to ensure that transfer into the city happens as soon as possible? And how do we unlock the problems that are there, that are creating the delays that are there? Acknowledge that there are delays, but the notion that we are intentionally refusing to transfer is a fallacy and should be dismissed. Thank you.
Any questions? On November?
Jefferson, thank you. Instead of questions, I would like to comment instead of posing a question. Because now this whole process has been turned up to election process. Maybe we need to make it clear here. This is not about elections. And this is also not about the ruling party. Because the committee itself, it's a multi-party committee. So as a multi-party committee, we're all responsible, not the ruling party. And elections is one of the rights that we've got with blood, kwafabantu, before we came to elections. We never knew about elections. So this should not be turned around to an election topic. To Jefferson, I don't think that we rushed the bill. This bill has not been rushed. We took our time. And I think by this now, up to this far, we've gone around this country. All 9 provinces, we had inputs from people off the ground. Because this government is about the people. They have to say, before we can pass laws and whatever we can do, it's all about people. We've run around this whole South Africa to hear what our people are saying. So there is no rush. I wish we could, the people that are saying that this Russian water could have been in those hearings that we held in each province. Just one question, Jefferson. It's the one that says that there must be an independent commission. Who'll pay the commission? The very same government, or the very same people, or who'll pay this commission? Because establishing a commission means that we have to pay those people that are going to go around and seek for some information. Jefferson, let me stop the inviting bashes.
Excuse me, there's no further questions on your side. Can you respond on the commission, please? Sorry, before you respond, you see, let me clarify one thing. I've given people to make comments and answers were given. And I must also make it clear that this forum is not about to make any decision whatsoever. It just makes presentations and there is a committee that will be properly and constitutionally constituted which will decide. So I don't want people to start raising hands, because otherwise they will confuse me in terms of how I run the meeting. People who spoke were ordered properly on my list. Now I see you raising your hand, but before I give him to answer, let me hear you.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I humbly appreciate this opportunity. I just want to clarify something with the Commissioner. On record, my name is Nomboniso Gasa. I'm with the Center for Law and Society. On record, Minister Ngwenke at the Land Divided Conference admitted, in fact informed us, that he had given instructions for the land not to be transferred to CPAs because of a number of issues, and he listed those. So when we say that instruction was given, we are talking about something that was said by the minister publicly on record at the conference. Thank you very much, Chair, for indulging.
It would be difficult for us as a committee to make any determination on the basis of that statement that you're making, unless you provide the committee with a written sort of statement that the minister made. But for now, we can't debate on that one because we don't actually know. We don't have any information. We'll appreciate if we can do that so that we can then know exactly where your information is coming from. Thank you. The question was directed to yourself on the commission. Who pays the commission? I think that was the question.
Chair, thank you. No, I'll simply say what the position is under the law at the moment. The commission is, of course, an independent body. It's just become indistinguishable from the department. The policy that the department published at the rather bears a date at the end of August and another one in July refers to the autonomous commission, the requirement for the commission to be autonomous. How do we strengthen it? There's one current problem. The Act provides for the appointment of regional commissioners. They're independent persons. They're not career officials. But there's only one, so the Chief Land Claims Commissioner and one Regional Land Claims Commissioner is currently kind of independent and came from outside. The rest are career bureaucrats in the nice sense of the word of being professional officials, not independent commissioners. You strengthen the commission by appointing further independent commissioners who can lead the commission. The commission has been mentioned in a number of court cases. We refer to them in our submission on its independent role that it must play. Strengthen the commission by appointing independent commissioners to the discipline of the public service commission and so on. Secondly, we're saying it's a problematic provision in the Act that says the commission must report to itself. Let it report to you and to the court about its performance and the settlement of claims. This bill is not rushed. Chair,
sorry, Mr. Smith, but the question is, who is going to pay the commission? Can you just respond to that question?
Chair, the commission, like any other, a number of other commissions, are paid for by government funding, similar to the Chapter 6 institutions, either under the Constitution or in certain cases by government departments. We've heard in an earlier presentation that the commission should be elevated in status to that of the revenue authority because it is so important that land reform now happens at speed. Chair, do you want me to address the issue the timing of elections and the timing of this bill is of course a political issue, but what we're saying is that in terms of the information before us as civil society organization, including the regulatory impact assessment and this document that deals in chapter 6 from page 114 to 125
I'm sorry to interrupt you. You see, this question of elections was not only raised by you. It was raised by many people who presented. Some of them raised it. So I don't really think that we should... But just take it as a point that has been raised. And not, you can't take it any further than that because, quite frankly, it can raise other questions as to when does the work of Parliament cease to exist. Does it cease to exist when it makes a legislation which is perceived to be controversial, or does it stop to exist when Parliament has been sort of adjourned on the basis of elections? It can raise those questions. But I think for me, if I allow you to answer that question, it won't take us anywhere, really. I think we better just leave it at that. It's the point that you made, others are made, it's the point that she made. I think we must just leave it at that. You just know that even in the public hearings, there are other people who raise this question.
to say that why this bill is coming closer to the elections. Whereas I don't want to engage in that kind of a debate. I don't even want to open that debate for that matter, because I'm convinced that it's not going to take us anywhere. But the fact of the matter is the bill is before us. The amendment legislation is before us. We have to deal with it. I think that's just the basic fact. And so I'm not going to allow you any further discussion, because I think we have made your presentation. These were questions. They asked you one question. You responded to it. And I think we leave it at that. That's how I did with other presenters. I don't have to set another precedent. That's how I did with other presenters. And it seems to me there are no further questions coming from the members, which means the question.
Just one to raise. I think we have had thorough engagement with the public on the role that is played by traditional leaders. It's true that there are those that are still trying to hold on to power and not giving their people the rights that they deserve. But I think it's unfair to, in your presentation, to just generalize and paint a picture of all of them being people that don't care about their community. Because some of us are coming from the rural areas where traditional leadership is our tradition, is our custom. And some of us can bear testimony to the fact that where we are coming from, there are those traditional leaders that are able to take their people forward. They are able to comply and able to consult with their people. They are able to, you know, walk with their people hand in hand to ensure that they get a better life. So I had to make that point, Chairperson. Thank you.
Would you like to comment on that one?
Thank you for that, and I accept that entirely. And of course, in the very limited time that one is given to present here, one overstates a position when it is on behalf of communities that don't have rights. So communities or community members who have traditional leaders, and there are many, who are happy with how they are governed, they of course don't have a problem. We are here to represent those who do have a problem, and those are the ones who do not have a voice. And who do not have a mechanism to protect the property rights that they have gained through, for example, restitution. And so the protection is there for anyone who is wanting to be governed by traditional leadership. We are here to ask the committee to also ensure that people who are not happy, who do not have mechanisms for accountability, that they are given those. And this restitution bill is one mechanism if CPAs are allowed to continue. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentations and the responses that have been given. Let me just say, by way of talk closing, say that we really appreciate your presence and your input. And as I said in the opening, in my opening remarks here, that we have traveled across the country to consult with people on this amendment, on the legislation. And it is clear that the issue of land is a very emotive issue. But we are called upon as leaders to address it. We can postpone it for so many times, it doesn't matter, but at the end of the day, we would prefer that we solve it ourselves, we drive it in terms of the dictates of the Constitution. We don't allow a situation where certain forces somewhere begin to come and drive this process, and you start running behind. I think one of the members said this morning, and I think it's important that we must keep that in mind as we deal with it. And I think it was said initially, especially by the late President Mandela, that we can use issues like these ones, very quite vexing issues, to build the nation as opposed to divide the nation. And I think all is not lost. We can still find a way of addressing it in a manner that at the end of the day we show sympathy to those who don't have land. We all come with ideas that can help to fast track the issue of ensuring that people who don't have land, who don't have access to land, do have land. And we keep in mind that when the process of dispossession began in 1913, on the 19th of June, the land that was dispossessed is still the same size of land that we have today, because the land does not multiply. It does not fall fragment and give birth to small pieces of land. It just remains the same land. What has increased, though, is the population. The population has increased. This also raises questions as to the people who need land have increased drastically. Now, it raises a bigger problem, which means, therefore, that those of us who enjoy the privilege of having land just constitute an island. The ocean is those who don't have land. You can imagine if that ocean begin to do things which I may not want to talk about. I'm just raising this to say that we must keep that in mind, because we must also learn from other countries which have similar problems than we do. I am looking towards a time when South Africans can, for example, say, those who have land can say, we are prepared as a gesture of reconciliation to donate this land to fellow South Africans who don't have land. I think it can go a long way. But if you say to those who don't have land, wait there, because processes are not yet ready to ensure that you get land, whereas in the process we are the privileged, we enjoy land, I don't think we are really doing justice to our fellow South Africans who are really in need of land. You know, I'm raising this thing because during the public hearings, I witnessed elderly people breaking up and crying. And sometimes it is a sleepless night when we get home. When an old man cry in front of young people, so I'm not able to sit here and say, let's not take this route, let's wait, let's not accelerate, let's do this. Immediately when we say these things, my mind starts playing back, thinking about those people who are crying. So I'm really making this plea to say, moving forward, I don't think all is lost. We have to make time, all of us, and go out there to the countryside. Because if we talk here, it doesn't strike home. We must go out to the countryside and address these people and see them standing there from 9 o'clock to 5 o'clock without lunch, just wanting to raise a voice about the plight of being landless. But I hope that very soon we realize the urgency of the moment and we start acting like wise. It doesn't matter which party is in power.
The fact is, the issue of land must be resolved. That is the bottom line. It must be resolved. So I'm therefore saying, colleagues and dear friends, let us make sure that we address this thing. But I'm satisfied that the public hearing is provided us with an opportunity to understand what South Africans are thinking about this matter of land. We are aware now what they think. The budget, sometimes they do complain about certain things, but and it's a pity, because the more you listen to the debate, the more you get sense that this issue creates class divisions. And I'm arguing that as we go back, let us begin to think very carefully about this matter. Let's think very carefully about this matter. And understand that as we live here, going into our comfort zone, there are men and women out there who are crying every day. Surely we can't ignore them. Otherwise we'll be heartless. We can't ignore them. We have to do something about it. Your contributions in these public hearings have been very helpful. As a committee, we'll go back, because did not only listen to people. You said to people, we'll listen to you, some of you who will speak, but we want all of some of you to write your submissions. We've got a lot of submissions, which I believe will not only contribute towards this particular legislation, but will help us in understanding the issue of the land and the agrarian reform moving forward. I don't want to create the impression that all is lost. All is not lost. I know South Africans are very resilient people. They can be able to rise above and resolve questions which the world thinks they are impossible to resolve. And therefore making this plea that moving forward, let us begin to think very carefully about what legacy we really want to leave as leaders of today. What legacy we want to leave. Well, the issue of the koi, I just want to say that what we're going to do as a committee, first and foremost, we're going to try and find out from the department, when we meet with them constitutionally, we're going to ask them, they must give us a briefing as to how far they in terms of this kind of a policy that they're developing. And I hear your point when you say that you want to be part and parcel of this particular bill. But as we speak right now, of course, the constitution, I had somebody saying the constitution doesn't say anything, but the constitution as we speak, as we understand it, it does not provide you an opportunity to participate in this particular exercise that we're doing. But I'm not a legal person. I think legal people can argue this point. I'm just arguing on the basis of what I can read in the constitution currently. But we will definitely make sure that the issue of the coin is taken seriously and as urgently as it is possible. Because the Koi and the San are not less South African. They are South African like all of us. So they must be, their issues must be dealt with just as we deal with any other matter that affect South Africans. So we will definitely take it further than that. Well, the issue of Mala Mala. I wish I could hear many voices condemning it. But there is dead silence from other quarters in terms of condemning it. But I wish I could hear consistency in terms of how we deal with this matter, so that we are able to identify issues of principle and we deal with those matters as principle issues.
So I hope that the commission will ensure that the issue that has been raised, the issue of capacity, the issue of the budget, the issue of political will, we will deal with as Parliament. We'll also try and play our role in terms of making sure that in whatever legislation that the department is trying to implement, there must be a political will to ensure that it is driven up to the end with less glitches as possible. Capacity is important. But as I said in my opening, I did indicate that there are some commitments that the Commission made in terms of responding to these challenges, and we hope that they will do so. I thank you very much for your participation, and we want to promise you that we will look into these matters that have been raised. We will also look at the matters raised by ordinary people out there and try and find a product which can be able to serve before Parliament. And of course, it's not only Parliament, as people have rightly said, the bill has been tagged to 76, which means it must also go through the six-week cycle of the National Council of Provinces. So we will do all those processes and see how far we end. But we have been given a task. It's not us who can determine whether the bill should or shouldn't be proceeded with. That's the work of Parliament. Parliament as a body, or the National Assembly as a body, can make that determination. We will only take what we have gathered and compile it into a report and table it in Parliament, and Parliament, in its own wisdom, can determine what's right and what is wrong. Thank you very much for participation. Drive safely. Bon voyage to those who are flying. The meeting is adjourned.